welcome back, one and all, at HTO Football, in your ears, on your social media. Hope you're all well. Hope you're sort of getting over the sort of second heat wave a bit. I'm with my co-host together, as ever, Andrew. We're going to talk today. We're going a little bit of a deep dive special on goalkeeping and some of the great goalkeeping partnerships and stories of years gone by, but also just talk about the evolution of the game. I think of all positions, it's probably changed the most in the depth and standard over the last 10, 15, 20 years. Andrew, it's going to be a fun chat, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think, like you just said there about the evolution of that particular role. I mean, at the moment, like, you know, the fullback, wingback position is something that's really hot in the press, isn't it? All over our analysis. But actually, you're right. I think if we're talking about the whole of history in terms of football, it's definitely the position that has seen the most change, for sure.
And also, we've got to mention it, because we've just come off a couple of the more goalkeeping howlers, you know, David De Gea, a couple of stinkers really against Brentford in United's big 4-0 loss there. What's fascinated me about the goalkeeping position is how we are seeing in the last, literally recent past, the last 2, 3, 4, 5 years, how top quality keepers are now being seen as defunct or not up to scratch because they can't play a certain way. They can't play their feet, they can't play out from their back. Their distribution is not fast enough or accurate enough. Even if you put them in another era and they would be considered a top goalkeeper, top shot stopper.
Yeah, I think, you know, if we go back a few years or even further, the main objective for a goalkeeper was to make saves and to keep the ball out of the net, which will never really be off of a goalkeeper's in tray or whatever you'd like to call it. But more so now than ever, I do feel like that I'm definitely in agreement that there's almost just an equal importance for being able to start attacks, play that sweeper role, anticipate more, not more so than making saves. But, you know, we're seeing at the moment with Arsenal a change of tact in that role where we had a goalie in Leno that was a great shot stopper. You could argue probably maybe slightly better than Ramsdale in that department. But the fact that he can't play out from the back was, you know, led to him being, like, you know, dropped and unsold. So
I think smarter men than me would have done the analysis. And I think we are seeing a world where coaches and managers of football clubs are probably willing to give up one or two errors more a season for the advantages that it gives. You know, Ramsdale's distribution the weekend was brilliant. You know, yet he did make one slight error, you could say, for the second goal, when actually, you know, miscommunication for the first one potentially as well. But distribution was fantastic, you know, and fast again to feet, and some of the range of passing they can do is brilliant. But I did want to ask you a question. We look at the pantheon of great goalkeepers. I think it's the Premier League's 30 years. Is it this weekend? This, you know, weekend just gone or just coming on?
A couple of days ago.
30 years of the Premier League, you know, this week. And you ask someone to name the best goalkeepers that this Premier League has ever seen in the last 30 years, you are going to get the names Peter Schmeichel. You're going to get the names David Seaman. You're going to get the names Edwin van der Sar. You're going to get the names Petr Cech. And all of those would absolutely struggle in the modern game. And it's frightening, really, because they gave so much to their teams. They always used to say, didn't they, the brilliant goalkeeper Peter Schmeichel's worth 10 or 12 points a season. They always used to say that was Sir Alex Ferguson did. And yet you're seeing managers move away from that brilliant shot stopper to that distribution piece. And I wonder, I always talk about football going in cycles. Will it go back to that? I'm not so sure. I think just the standard that they expect their goalkeeper to be able to play at dictates that being a shot stopper isn't enough.
I'd like to include the back four or back three, whatever you're playing in that defensive. If we put a goalkeeper and a defender in this defensive bracket, let's just call them all defensive players for the sake of the argument. You know, if we look back over the last 30 years of the Premier League, that's the area of the pitch that's seen more change and more demand on the roles that are out there. You know, I don't think we're asking midfield players and strikers to do necessarily a lot more than they used to. If we're going for like a, you know, layman, just basic, you know, defenders, centre-backs, they're being asked to play under pressure with the ball, keep it on the floor, play 1-2s in their own box. Like, look at Palace and Palace's goal last night, you know, working it fairly well out of Liverpool's box to counter-attack. You've got goalkeepers, as we're focusing on this episode, you've got fullbacks and wingbacks having to do would a Gary Neville, how would a Gary Neville cope in today's modern game? Yeah, one of the best right backs in Premier League history, you know. So it's and Jamie Carragher, because they come as a pair, so you know, they'd have to drop a bit.
But you're right, and you know, those two positions have changed beyond belief. And again, you were talking about coaches and managers potentially willing to sacrifice some defensive stability for the attacking potential, which I think is quite a nice thing. Obviously, you want to watch attacking football, you want to watch goals, you know, as a fan, especially when you're a neutral fan watching a game potentially without your side. I mean, I'd happily take a 1-0 win every week if it meant we're definitely going to win. But if you're a neutral, you do want to see goals, don't you? No one wants to watch a 0-0, no one wants to watch a 1-0. You'd much rather watch a 3-2 game, a 4-3 game, you know, even if it's just a hard-blooded 2-1, fantastic stuff. But look at Trent. Trent is in many ways redefining the right back role, wing back role, full back role. What he's, the numbers he puts up in the last 3, 4, 5 years from a XG, XA perspective. And yet there is no one can deny that there are some defensive frailties there.
You need your right back now to play second striker for the last half an hour, don't you?
This is it. I mean, like, you know, I texted you the other day. I said, like, Trent should just sack off being a fullback, because if he was just a right winger, he'd still be brilliant.
Well, last night, to be fair, they didn't have anyone to bring off the bench, Liverpool, but he was playing as a central striker for the last 20 minutes of that match. You know, it's just ridiculous. Like,
and that's your right back.
We are a big fan of Lionel Messi on this podcast, and I'm sure many others are, but I do feel this is a bit of a lazy link, but we probably got Messi to blame for this in terms of the whole goalkeeping evolution and the way teams play out from the back now. Because people look at Pep, don't they? And they say, oh, you know, Pep's Barca side changed the way football played. And you could argue that if you go back to 2008, 2009, where he takes over, that probably is a huge moment for football tactically in terms of European football. However, if he doesn't have a Messi, Is that Barca team the greatest, one of the greatest teams ever? Maybe not. And it doesn't play the football that it goes on to play. You can look at people like Johan Cruyff as well, that some of these players, and like Messi, Cruyff, these are game changers. They're not just amazing talents. They change the development of the game and the sport. You know, like look at the Ajax football that Cruyff inspired. You know, I know he had the coaches to obviously make that come to fruition, but I do think every now and then you get a player like a Messi, who, and the coaches obviously take the credit for the evolution side of things, but without these players to do it,
it doesn't change. You know, football's the same in respect of coaches will play to the players that they have available, and it sometimes dictate the pathway they take from a tactics perspective. And I think that's happened there, and I think it happens continually now. But like, to me, it's strange as well that the profile of the actual individual has changed so much as well, because we were lucky enough to have Arsenal goalkeeping legend Bob Wilson on the podcast, one of a friend of the podcast, in fact, on a few occasions. And, you know, Arsenal double winning goalkeeper from the 70s, 1971. And what a different profile. He kept on telling us that what you needed to be was ridiculously brave, strong, a bit crazy. Not even goalkeeper gloves back in those early days of him. And, you know, now goalkeepers are very protected. They're essentially, like you said, sweepers, you know, almost a sort of like a, you know, the passing range we got, if we're talking about goal sweeper keepers, the passing range of Edison at Man City is a joke. It's like, it would be championship level central midfielder.
They're playmakers, aren't they?
Yeah. And it's also the speed of vision as well and distribution to see things, which has changed beyond compare. And I think, you know, it'd be nice to sort of maybe talk to a footballing family, a dynasty of a Schmeichels or something like that, where you have Peter Schmeichel and obviously his son Casper both going on to achieve great success. Peter probably more so, but you know, Casper nonetheless goes and wins the title, wins the FA Cup, not bad career. Obviously moved on this summer. And to compare them in their profiles, you still see a lot of Peter about Casper's game and in respect of, you know, commanding your area, shot stopping, strong voice, vocal, commanding your defence. But actually, you know, it's probably the last era that we're seeing the keeper necessity on that level of responsibility.
And you know, fair play to Casper. He's had a great career, Premier League winner, but you know, he's gone off to France somewhere, hasn't he? To Nice, I believe. And he was never going to play for a club in the Premier League that are fighting for titles, because he's not good enough with the ball at his feet. So he's a good shot stopper and he's quite commanding, like his dad was. But interesting you talk about the personality, because I was reading up a little bit about this very briefly, about the changing of that as well over the years where, you know, when we were at school, it was someone in goal that was either a bit crazy, a little bit kind of didn't mind putting their head in the wrong places, or wasn't particularly good with the ball at their feet, right? Mm. And I think now, I don't think that tag of the crazy one is necessarily like, I don't think that's doesn't really ring true anymore, to be honest. I think goalkeepers are a lot more, I won't say smart, that's probably doing them a bit of a disservice, the older guys, but I do think that years ago, like in that Schmeichel Seaman era, and obviously decades before that, you did have to have a little bit of that eccentricness about you.
Bartes, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and they're not
brings out Bartes,
they're not these barking dogs anymore. You know that they're not like that. You look at people like Edison and even Alisson, who Alisson's got a little bit more of an old schoolness about him to a degree. He's not an Edison, but they're not these beasts that just come out and claim everything from corners. And I did want to ask you as well about that side of things, like set plays, corners, because I feel there's been a reduction in that in terms of coming out and claiming things all the time. You know, it was all the time they were coming and getting things, you know?
You know, I think what we saw at the era change when, like, you know, in English football, it was very English, very, you know, very old layman's term to say, you come and catch your ball. And then the European football came in with punching. And then there was punch the ball. And for a long time, you know, you could probably say staid commentators were outraged that the goalkeepers were punching now and not catching the ball. And now I think it's gone even further. I think you're right. The goalkeepers very rarely come and claim the ball. You know, they very rarely come and claim the ball. Again, it's, I don't know whether it's that bravery piece. I don't know whether it's that command piece, whether their role has changed or whether, frankly, they are just there to do it. Their impetus is different. And maybe just their style and nature and their innate personalities are different. And I think one phrase that always sticks out with me when you speak to any goalkeeper at any level is the goalkeepers union. And how that
strikers union's the other one, isn't it?
Yeah, like a goalkeepers union, that how that goalkeepers would have great respect and friendship with one another even when they're on opposite teams. Like, you know, you still sit in the tunnel today, the goalkeeper will go over to the fellow goalkeeper and you know, give them a little high five, give them a little handshake, because, you know, in many respects you are the last line of defense. You're probably going to be slated if you make an error, because your error is going to lead to a goal. And there is that sort of camaraderie in that little bit of craziness. And maybe that will go as well when you just essentially have a sweeper keeper to be part of the proposition. But for me, look, you look at the Premier League now, your standout keepers, like you said, your Edisons, you know, your Alissons, your Ramsdales, beyond, like they are players who are making the game about the distribution versus about their shot stopping ability. And I think that will continue. I'll be really interested to see what it looks like in 10 years' time. You know, I think we all used to play on the playground, sort of rush goalkeeper, anyone could be in goal. And, you know, you're almost getting to that vibe, aren't you, where they could be an outfield player. Whoever's just closest to the sticks, you know, you're in goal. And yeah, I think that goalkeeper's union's gone. But talking about another goalkeeper's union today, we, you know, it's an apt conversation. We're very lucky to have an author of Eric and Dave, Last Lines, which is a fantastic novel about two of the finest goalkeepers in Britain, and their careers, but also their friendship, which lasted 50, 60, 70 years. We're very lucky to have the author with us, Spencer. So we're going to hear a little bit about the book. I think we're going to give one away, are we?
We'll say that for later.
Okay, we might be giving one. Maybe I've done that. Maybe a little, let that cat out of the bag, but we'll save that for later.
We want them to listen to the whole episode, Tom, don't we?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, they want to hear how great the book is, don't they, Spencer? Spencer, how are you? Are you well?
Am I well? I'm absolutely fine and dandy, thank you very much. Yes, I'm recovering from, I've had an operation on my left foot. So I say I'm well. I'm better than I was this time last month, put it that way. In less pain, but then again, I'm still on crutches and kind of hobbling around, so I am well, getting better by the day.
Back for the January transfer window. Fit for them?
Hopefully, I've got to see. I can't even say it. January transfer window in walking football, possibly.
It's the big one. It's the big one. I imagine I can only a midnight deadline day. Spence makes a move. Walking football, it's going to happen. So, Eric and Dave, if you've never heard of it, what's it about in sort of a, that elevator pitch, and then I want to deep dive into where you had the story and why you got fascinated.
Oh, okie dokie, fair enough. Well, Eric and Dave are Eric Gill and Dave Hollins, who were two ex-goalkeepers who first met at Brighton in 1955 as rivals, basically. Went on to have, you know, they had great careers, but here they are all of these years later. Eric will be 92 later this year, and Dave will turn 85 on his next birthday, and they're still best mates. So it's almost like, you know, they talk about the keeper's union. This is just an extreme example of that, an extreme example of it in football and sport, because you don't tend to get people who've been, you know, meeting sport and then continue being best mates all their lives. You know what it's like often in football, you know, footballers, once they leave one club, don't tend to stay in contact with most of their teammates, you know, ever. That footballers are lousy at keeping in touch with each other unless they're in, you know.
And I'm sure increasingly so as well in this the sort of the modern game and the way it's sort of played and dealt with, seen very much more as a job. And Andrew and I are massive Arsenal fans, and we were lucky enough to have a few members of the 89 sort of title win at Liverpool on the pod over the years. And yeah, they were told stories of going back to the snooker club on the night after beating Liverpool and celebrating with some fans in a real camaraderie. I just wouldn't get that now, that closeness of bond between either the players or the fans. You couldn't just go and play and celebrate in the street with fans. It'd be bedlam after a title win.
Never happened. And I think with some, you know, the Arsenal, you know, that kind of team might be slightly, some teams, you know, if you win something and if you're a great team who won lots of silverware, then there will be reunion dinners and occasions where they do get together. But by and large, what you tend to find is that those events, you know, the hard yards behind them are put in by the clubs themselves or the supporters who remember them fondly. If it was left to the players themselves, you know, it they probably wouldn't get off the ground. So to actually have, you know, two ex-goalkeepers who met 70 years ago, who've just got this organic friendship where they just go to the DIY store together and stuff like that. And they still play sport. They don't play in goal anymore, obviously, not even walking football anymore, but they still bowl every week. Eric's down in Sussex and Dave moved back to Sussex just before COVID. And so they're neighbours now after all these years. So they see each other even more.
Amazing.
So,
How did you come across in a friendship?
Well, for my sins, I'm the guy when it comes to the Brighton and Hove Albion Matchday magazine. I write all of the features, which is about, you know, ex-players, ex-seasons, you know, pre-Premier League, even early days of the Premier League, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s, 1980s, 1990s, whatever. Just in the early days of like the COVID lockdown, we decided we were going to kind of carry on with the program, you know, a printed version of it. And I was interviewing ex-players, and I interviewed Eric Gill, who I knew was probably our oldest surviving player. I didn't know of anybody older than him, who was a goalkeeper, made his debut, Eric, for Charlton Athletic at Old Trafford in 1951. And he left Charlton, went to Brighton, and he went on to basically created a Football League record for the most amount of consecutive games played by a goalkeeper. This was during the 1950s. So Eric, you know, when I started going to Brighton in the late 70s, Eric was a bit of a kind of, you know, the older fans used to talk about him as this legendary ex-keeper. And I thought, yeah, I want to speak to this guy. So, you know, we had a chat and it was brilliant. And he was telling me all about, you know, playing for Charlton, playing for Brighton and playing at Old Trafford and dodging bombs during the Blitz, because he had clear memories of the Blitz. He had some near misses during that. It was just fantastic. And then in the middle of it all, I was talking about Dave, his mate Dave, who I didn't know he was still mates with at the time, who was Eric's understudy throughout all of this. Imagine understudying a goalkeeper who is creating a Football League record for the most amount of consecutive games played. I mean, you know, you have to have the patience of the saint. And right in the middle of the interview, Eric just happened to say, oh yeah, we're still mates. And it was like, what? You know, doing my maths, trying to work out how many years ago this all was.
Yeah, with the greatest respect, that's an achievement unto itself, let alone the friendship.
No, exactly.
I'll be happy to get there.
Yeah. And I let it go at the time because we were doing the interview and whatever. And then I went back to it a couple of days later. I said, you said you're still mates with Dave. He went, yeah, I'm seeing him tomorrow. And it was like, you think, well, this is something a little bit different. So I said to Eric, you know, I wrote my piece about Eric and that went in One Match program. And I said to him, look, you know, have you got a number for Dave? Can I give him a buzz? And he said, yeah, give him a call. I've had a word with him already. He paved the way. So I phoned Dave and did an interview with him. And Dave is remarkable because, as I said, he understudied Eric at the Goldstone Ground, Brighton's old home, for many years. For all of this time, you know, as a young man. And then he finally got his breakthrough. When Eric got flu. And in his fourth game in between the posts for Brighton, he conceded 9 goals up at Middlesbrough. Brighton's first ever match, 1958, in the second tier, which was Division 2 then, the Championship now. And yeah, Brighton were up at Middlesbrough. And Middlesbrough had a young centre-forward at the time called Brian Clough, who one or two people may have heard of. And that day, Middlesbrough stuffed Brighton 9-0. Brian Clough got 5 goals. And Dave, at that point, you think you waited all of this time to get your opportunity. And then in your fourth game, basically, you know, you concede 9. You think at that point, you know, goalkeepers 10, you know, you get the message, you go away. But one of Brighton's players at that time was, I think some of your older listeners may remember, a guy called Dave Sexton, managed Manchester United. I think he also managed England under 21s. Mm. And Dave was one of Brighton's players at the time. And on the train back from the northeast of England back down to King's Cross, he took Dave aside. You know, Dave Sexton took Dave Hollins aside. Basically said, look, you know, forget this. Move on. You're going to be a great keeper. You're going to have a good career. Forget this. Just erase it. Just move on with your career. And sure enough, Dave did. He got about a year or so later. A couple of years later, he got a big money move to Newcastle United. Well, I say a big money move. This is a big money move for 1961 with the fee of, drum roll please, £11,000.
I can edit a drum roll in.
Yeah, you're going to have to do that. It's, you know, £11,000 for a keeper in 1961 was, you know, a lot of money.
Yeah, I bet.
So yeah. Dave went on to play for Newcastle United and ended up becoming Wales's keeper between about 1962 and 1966. Took over from, was it Jack Rowley, wasn't it, who was the Arsenal keeper? Rowley. Jack Rowley played for Charlton. He was the Charlton. Manchester United centre-forward. Jack Kelsey. Jack Kelsey. Took over from Jack Kelsey for Wales and kind of held the position until Gary Sprake came along. You know, was Leeds United's keeper, kind of, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s. So, yeah, you know, he went from, you know, not being able to get a game to conceding 9 to playing for Newcastle, saving a penalty against Jackie Blanchflower on his debut for Newcastle, and then playing for Wales, you know, rooming with the great John Charles and playing against Pele on his debut.
Mm.
You just think, my God, you know, that's a story of redemption. So, they just had stories coming out of them left, right, and centre about back then and now, and you just think it was this amazing story. Their friendship, their careers, both together and as individuals, and it was kind of bookmarked by World War II and COVID, because here were two, you know, two people, you know, in their Indian summers of their lives, you know, going through this horrible thing that was just picking off seemingly elderly people, young people in particular.
For the non-versed, where did Eric's career go? Did he stay at Brighton? Did he?
He stayed at Brighton. He stayed at Brighton. He was he had a falling out towards the end of his career there with Brighton's manager, and back then. This is remarkable. This shows you how football has changed. All the cards when it came to contracts back then lay with the clubs. You know, it was like footballers basically in Eric's career and in the early days of Dave's career. You were pretty much living on a year-by-year basis. You know, if it got to like May at the end of a season, you had to just wait and see if basically the club wanted you again. after the end of the summer.
Oh, very much so. Very good. Very cutthroat. We were fortunate enough, as I alluded to earlier, but we Bob Wilson, ex-Arsenal goalkeeper, is a friend of the pod, and we've had him on a couple of times, and we do bits and pieces with him. And he alluded to the fact that one of the reasons his dad didn't want him to do anything to do with football was the fact that it's not a proper career. You'll never earn anything. You know, you just be dropped by clubs that left, right, and centre.
I mean, with Eric's case, I mean, Eric had a falling out with Brighton's manager, and Brighton's manager, because managers held all the power then, basically just wouldn't release his paperwork. Bristol City wanted him, a couple of other clubs wanted him, and Brighton's manager just refused to do deals with him. So the only way that Eric could go, if he wanted to continue playing, was to go non-league. So at the age of, in his early 30s, he ended up playing for Guildford City, who were kind of quite a Manchester United of the non-league scene back then. And funnily enough, the money he was on at Guildford was about the same as he was on at Brighton. And he had a really good kind of time there and played there throughout his 30s, almost up until, his 40s, and had a testimonial there. But it was such a waste. So many other players also went the same way. If you fell out with your club, they could make your life an utter misery and pretty much just terminate your career there and then.
I guess a life led very, very, very normally in retirement for the gents. I mean, clearly not fated with the riches of millionaire status that footballers of today enjoy.
For
what are two very established, very accomplished goalkeepers who, frankly, were operating at the sharp end all of their careers.
Yeah.
Now you'd probably retire in your mid-30s and you could live a pretty comfortable life for the rest of it.
Yeah, you would, providing you've looked after your money and everything. No, Eric went on to become a hotelier in Brighton. Fantastic. Owned a guest house and then moved up in the world and got a big hotel on the seafront. So he did that for the rest of his life with help from his good wife and his children. And Dave went into plumbing, basically, and decorating. Decorating was, I think he did plumbing to start with, but decorating kind of like after that. Decorating homes in his, he moved back to Guildford, where he was originally from. So he was doing kind of homes in the stockbroker belt, kind of around there, and earned quite a bit of money, doing that. He did that for the rest of the life. Because his dad had said to him that basically, like you alluded to with Bob Wilson, but basically you need a trade. You've got to have a trade. So get a trade in. So he'd gone to college around about the time when he was first signing for Brighton and being a young apprentice. He'd also kind of done evening courses and whatever in decorating and handiwork and stuff. Should also say the two of them are so old, and they won't mind me saying this, they also did national service as well.
Yeah, of course.
Although I say do national service. National service was really interesting for footballers because basically if whatever unit you went to had somebody in charge of that unit who loved football, then you were looked after. If basically you got to a unit where that person hated footballers, life could become very, very difficult for you. And an awful lot of them ended up getting injured and kind of, never resumed their careers. But Eric and Dave, they were all right. They were kind of various bribes paid, well, not bribes, little incentives. It's like Dave's commander down at Southampton, where he did his national service, used to send cigars and a wad of match tickets to Brighton every month, just to kind of help grease the wheels, so to speak. Eric had the same thing as well. He joined his unit basically won the Army Cup, which was like the big thing for the it was like the FA Cup equivalent for when you were doing your national service and whatever. So he won an Army Cup winner's medal and ended up getting his medal presented to him by the Queen Mother and the King at the time. So this is how long ago we're talking.
So for any listeners that might think that Dave Hollins rings a bell, Spencer, can you clarify that?
Yes. Well, his brother, so to speak, played for your team, amongst others, and Chelsea, and trying to think, managed Swansea. trying to think where else he played. Where else did he play in London? I mean, Chelsea and Arsenal were his big clubs.
Yeah, yeah, the two sort of standouts.
So, yeah, they were very much a football family. His older brother also played football, Dave's older brother, although he was injured out in national service. He wasn't so lucky. Yep, Dave played football. And their father, funnily enough, was also a goalkeeper.
QPR, yeah, Chelsea, QPR, Arsenal.
Oh, QPR, of course.
One cap for England I've got down here.
Well, that's the fascinating thing about the two of them.
Wow.
They were that classic example of two brothers. Good public pub quiz question. You know, what brothers who were raised together basically ended up playing international football for two different countries?
Yeah.
And of course, one ended up, one cap for England, and yeah, Dave ended up playing for Wales.
That's amazing. I mean, over 400 appearances for Chelsea, and one, well, more than that, because he was there for two spells with one cap for England.
We should, of course, say this is John Holland.
Who
was, yeah, great player, fantastic, and went into management as well. Mm. And is still with us. Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like an absolutely cracking read. I can't wait to get my hands on a copy, Spencer. What would you say that's the story that you've sort of whistle-stopped us through, I guess? What was your aim? What was your aim in terms of how to paint that story then, to put it on paper? What were the themes you wanted to explore?
The themes I really wanted to explore were what football was like then, compared to now, and just friendship and their lives. It was a marvelous opportunity to really go back and just kind of, you know, see how football has changed. I'm not one of those, you know, over those years, I'm not one of those who says, oh, you know, it was better then. You know, I'm not one of those who sits with rose-tinted, you know, glasses on and whatever, because it painfully wasn't. You know, as we've touched on, you know, the situation with contracts was just ridiculous. And I mean, the fact that when you played your last game of the season, you then went and kind of your wages dropped for the summer as well. You know, you've got kind of like a fee during the season, you've got a fee which would last during the summer. I mean, it's just bonkers. So there was a lot about football then that you know, wasn't all good. And I just, it was a learning curve for me, really. I wanted to find out about stuff like that too. So, yeah. Yeah, it's really that, you know, football through the years and, you know.
And you do mention friendship. You do mention friendship, and obviously it's a friendship that's clearly endured for many, many years. And was that a friendship that sort of dovetailed in many respects? Because I imagine, given, you know, work would pull them to different sides of the country, you don't have the joys of globalization and internet connectivity and Zoom calls as we are doing now. I mean, were they close at different points in their life, or was there always constant communication and friendship there?
I think there was one period when Dave moved up to Newcastle, when Newcastle United bought him in 1961. Where they didn't speak so much. I mean, you know, moving to Newcastle in 1961, you know, was probably, you know, the equivalent of moving to the moon. There was no kind of, you know, motorways, not what they were now. You know, you didn't do internal air travel so much or whatever. It was train or bus, really. They talk about the keepers' union, don't they?
They do, and we've heard that comment a couple of times on our pod when we've had goalkeepers on. And
yeah, from Bob and everything. And it's true, it is very true, although... It was funny. I said about all the keepers union, you know, of course, blah, 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 to Eric. And Eric went, well, there wasn't really a keepers union in our day. And I was like, oh, really? You know, tell me more. And he said, well, back then, you know, if you were in the first team, you got your money. If you were in the reserves, you didn't get anything like the same amount of money. So he said rivalry and bitterness could kind of develop. You know, if you weren't in the first team, you could struggle, really struggle to make a living. But that wasn't the case with him and Dave. And Dave always just believed that at some point he would get the opportunity, his opportunity would come along. And sure enough, it did. But there was never any bitterness, or there was a rivalry, a healthy rivalry between the two of them, but never any lingering resentment or anything, which you can get, or you could get at that time, definitely.
Absolutely. And so a bit more details then. When's publication? When can people get their hands on a copy?
Oh, it's out now. Just come out. Just in the last few days. You can get it through Pitch Publishing. who are the publishers, any good bookstore, or through the Pitch website itself, or probably Amazon as well. I know it's on Amazon, all the usual channels, basically. I think Waterston's got some issues at the moment, doesn't it? It keeps on trending left, right, and centre because...
Yeah, so unfortunately so. We'll have to wait and see, I guess. And I guess you alluded, one question I wanted to ask, you alluded to them still playing bowls regularly. Did you go and pit your wits in some lawn bowls against Dave and Eric?
Oh, they wouldn't suffer me. They're funny. But I mean, the idea that, oh, nice game of bowls. They're like, game? You know,
that's the follow-up, you see. That's the sequel, how actually then Eric and Dave hung up their football boots and their goalkeeper's gloves and then went hustling on the lawn bowls scene, taking people's money up and down greens across the UK.
Which wouldn't be true, dare I say it, but it might be a nice screenplay.
Absolutely. I they might love it. I can see them on stage now. I can see them on stage.
Why let the truth get in the way of a good story like that? Absolutely. I think that would be brilliant, wouldn't it? Yeah. No, I mean Eric still, you know, Dave's a little bit more laid back about it, but Eric is still, he still plays to win. He's still got a competitive spirit that is second to none. I mean, I was down, what was it? They play Newhaven for a club in Newhaven in Sussex. I was down there in March, and he just finished playing a match with, he'd been on a team of four. And he was grumbling away that one of the four hadn't been at it and had let the side down. And you just think, oh, this is just marvellous. He was doing it in a nice way, but you could tell he cared, you know. So I found them an inspiration. You know, I'm 53, and you just think, yeah, you know, how to grow old kind of, you know, with something about you. You know, I mean, my kind of generation, I think we always remember our grandparents who seemed old at 60. You know, these were two people who you know were, you know, 91 and 84, and I mean, you know, they were just kind of still living life, you know. Yeah. So that's what I loved about them.
No, absolutely, and that, I think that's why we're all, you know, Andrew and I are so keen to get our hands on our copies and give it a read, because I think it is those stories of friendship and family that endure across football. It's the reason so many of us love the game. And you know, you could argue that it's slightly moving away a little bit, which would be a shame, but definitely not.
I think you're right, Tom. Yeah, and the other thing is, sorry, Tom, just talking over the top of you, as I'm prone to do every now and then. The other thing is, of course, is that these guys, you know, they're going. Oh, a lot of them have gone. I mean, as you know, it's in one of the, well, a couple of the chapters in there, you know, we touch on dementia, and I mean, they were aware of what was going on involving their teammates before I think anybody else was, but it's just, it didn't have a name then. They didn't understand what was going on. And of course, it was their outfield player teammates, you know, the centre-backs, centre-forwards who were all going down with it. The goalkeepers don't seem to, you know, they've got aches and pains and dodgy knees and whatever, but in terms of mentally and in terms of, you know, their heads, they're still together, you know, in their 80s and 90s, whereas they've seen so many of their teammates, you know, suffer through dementia, you know, for many, many decades now. Mm. So just going back to it, it was, you know, if we don't write this stuff down now, and of course so much of football history, you know, was fish and chip paper and just kind of got thrown away. And we didn't realise its importance. So I think that's part of what I wanted to do. I want to tell their stories now before it's too late, because once guys like that are gone, they're gone.
Yeah, I mean, the Erics and Daves of this world, and we were so lucky to mention the fact that we've spoken to Bob Wilson before, and he's part of the discussion we had on the podcast was also that, you know, the importance to sort of still be able to share these stories at the age that he is. And lucky for people like us to be on the receiving end of it and be able to learn, digest it and learn about it, because it's nothing like first-hand experience, is there, from someone? So
not at all. And I mean, there's, you know, from the 60s, we've got, you know, there seems to be, you know, what with England winning the World Cup in 66, and there seems to be, you know, a fondness for almost 66 kind of onwards, you know, where stories have been told, books have been written. But pre-66, there really isn't that much. And particularly about the 50s. I mean, when you talk about goalkeeping in the 50s, there seems to be this kind of theory now that goalkeeping pre-Gordon Banks, particularly in Britain, was just, you know, a load of old pony, basically. And that Gordon Banks changed it and everything, and that, goalkeeping kind of went up, you know, through the gears after Gordon, he started it. Whereas before then, I mean, yeah, you know, goalkeeping wasn't always what it was in later years. But of course, these were guys who used to have to deal with muddy pitches. You know, there were no gloves. You know, they didn't have gloves in those days or anything. They had to deal with being battered by outfield players who used to just, you know, there was no protection. I mean, we think there was little or no protection in the 70s or, you know, 60s, 70s. Go back to the 50s. I mean, there's that famous footage. What's the Bolton-Manchester United Cup final game? I'm trying to think what it is, but the Bolton keeper, is it? No, it's Harry Gregg, the Manchester United keeper, being smashed into the back of the net by Stan Mortensen, I think. And the goal was given. So goalkeepers, you know, they just weren't protected at all. So, you know, I mean, I think we're allowed to cut them a little bit of slack, goalkeepers from the 50s, because what they were dealing with was, you know, completely different.
Yeah, you're right, actually. I didn't think of that before in this sort of glorified era of the 66 team and how it's sort of uncharted sort of waters, really, before that, in terms of like a historical perspective that we get from this day and age. I mean, it's the 50s, you had some unbelievable goalkeepers that people... We don't necessarily hear too much about that era, do we? But like someone like Lev Yashin, for example, I was reading up just in prep for this podcast because my goalkeeping knowledge isn't great, to be honest. Yeah. I was an outfield player myself, and it's he was the one that almost made throwing out, like, you know, clearing the ball with his arm, like, a big thing. You know, that from the Hungarian team with Puskas, and then Yashin sort of moved that on with the whole distribution with his arms, and it's fascinating, really.
But like you say, you know, with this sharing a team with people like Puskas, and yes, that would be a name which is fairly household amongst most sensible football fans. Mm. I'm suggesting potentially wouldn't be, and that's you know, serves to show Spencer's point that actually goalkeeping was an art that was viewed as necessary, but not one to be celebrated or fated in the way we would look at top goalkeepers now. And Andrew and I were talking pre-joining us, Spencer, about how the role of the goalkeeper has changed so much that essentially now it's less about the shot stopping, more about the way they break forward and then with distribution, etc., etc. But it's for this first time, at least, it is shining a light on what is as important, if not more important, role than anything else on the pitch. So I think this story will not only do that and clearly celebrate that goalkeepers union, but celebrate a fantastic friendship and another story that is told, which is always lovely.
Well, we do.
We can't have enough stories, lads, can we, really? It's particularly, you know, from back then, as I said, if they don't get told back then, you know, we've got the internet now and things and different ways of storing stories, but back then we didn't. So
And I've definitely this is 100% rose tinted glasses that I'm talking with right now. However, I do wonder if in 70 years' time will there be two goalkeepers now that are playing in the Premier League that are playing bowls with each other, you know, when they're 90 years of age, or it's just the chances of that happening are probably really slim, aren't they? And I think the game has changed. You know, Tom mentioned earlier about the way, and I think you also alluded to it, Spencer, about football's a game where it's quite brutal in a way. You move on from clubs. And there was an interview with Rob Holden the other day, the Arsenal centre-back, and he was speaking about Pablo Mari had just left Arsenal to go back to Italy. And he said he didn't even have a chance to sort of say bye to him or anything. It was just literally like a quick thumbs up as he was leaving the training ground and see you later. And Rob said, well, that's just football. You know, people come and go.
Yeah. And in that respect, that hasn't changed. I think, you know, as Eric and Dave both said, you know, it was the way back then as well, that kind of nature. So, you know, so there is that kind of almost nomadic aspect to it. You know, you go where the work is, really. So friendships don't tend to develop. You know, you'll get on with each other and stuff. And if you happen to see each other again, you know, or in the same room again, you know, you'll talk to each other and whatever. But yeah, that you know, the genuine friendships, you're right, Andrew. You know, they don't tend to be there.
Hmm. Well, if you like your football history, listeners, I'm sure you'll be pleased to know we will be giving away a copy of Spencer's new book, which is out now. So keep your eye on our Twitter page at HTO Football for all the details of how to enter. I'll tag Spencer and Pitch in the post as well for a bit of a push there. But keep your eyes on it, guys, for a free giveaway. And Hopefully you enjoy the story. It sounds like a sounds like a really poignant cracker.
Yeah, cracker, and one I think everyone will enjoy. And of course, if you're not lucky enough to win, you can always go and buy a copy, which is what we'd recommend. Spencer, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for joining us.
That's great. Thanks, Tom. Thanks, Andrew.
Take care, Spencer.